You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Good afternoon and welcome to the Wilf Peace and Justice Hour. My name is Tana Hartman. I'm your host today, and our engineer is the intrepid Dick Paddock. Our guest today is Michael Dunn. I'm delighted to have Michael here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Michael's a local artist, a writer, and we're going to talk today about a book that he had worked on with a group of other artists from this area. Michael, tell us first about this book. The book is called Our Voices, First Person Accounts of Schizophrenia, and it is edited by a group of five people, you among them, Colette Kaur, your wife Claudia Moon, mm-hmm. Pickens Miller, and Manisha Kapil. How did you all come to write this book?
Well, Colette Kaur, who's we call ourselves author editors, because the book itself is primarily a collection of 20 interviews of people with schizophrenia. And Colette, this was Colette's brainchild, her idea, and she approached, this was before I had met my wife, Claudia. In fact, we met working on the book, and she had approached me singly, as well as Claudia and the other authors, and said she had this idea for a book, and she knew we were writers, and would we be interested in helping out? And so we labeled ourselves the book committee and met for 4 years.
4 years?
To put it together, yeah.
That took a lot of dedication.
Yeah, it did.
And you had the support of a couple of other people, B.B. Smith among them, who is the co-director of the Center for Excellence in Mental Health at UNC, and of the STEP clinic, the Schizophrenia Treatment and Evaluation Program there.
That's right, and also Jenny Edwards, who's a social worker.
Jenny, yes.
They were so important to the whole process. They kept us together, kept us on task, and sometimes we went off task, but, Jenny was... She was the workhorse as far as typing all these interviews up.
She did?
She did all that.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, I knew she worked hard, but
yeah,
I didn't realize
and, she... And then Bibi was very instrumental, not only in leading the meetings at times, but getting a grant. There was an anonymous gift to the STEP clinic at UNC Mental Health to publish the book.
So how did you decide on the format for this book? I mean, you all even designed the questionnaires, right? And you submitted them to how many people actually?
Well, we started out brainstorming questions, and then we used the five of us who all have schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder to pilot the questions and the questionnaire, and then we sort of fine-tuned over time to elicit hopefully better responses. And then once we had our questionnaire together, we went out and sought friends and ran into people in various places that we knew. And Club Nova was a source for some of the interviews. And we had everyone chose a fake first name to give some sort of, well, to hopefully elicit more honest responses. And then the five of us, we had a meeting to decide whether we would use our own names on the book. We decided as a group to do that, partially to combat, stigma.
Yes, stigma. So. That is a very loaded word, as I've learned from personal experience. I want to step back just a minute, and I'd like to talk a little bit about schizophrenia and what it is. I think there's a very common notion of it as what people think of as what do they used to call it, split personality, but that's not what it is.
No, they're actually what are called positive and negative symptoms. Mostly people that are a little aware of the illness know of the positive symptoms: hallucinations, delusions. Hallucinations may be auditorial, where you hear voices, or visual, which is less common, where you see things that aren't really there, at least not in the physical realm. And then there are negative symptoms such as catatonic behavior, which is less frequent, where you're almost like in a trance, where you don't respond to to people. Also, you may lose motivation, and you may become, you know, unhappy. And often, like with schizoaffective disorder, you have a mood element, depression or mania, or a fluctuation therein. So that plays a part too. And then there may be social withdrawal. You may have social anxiety because you're worried how people will view you, and you know, it may affect your ability to go out and be in public and that sort of thing, or to meet new people. You may be afraid of doing that.
It can be very debilitating, I know, and it's apparently there are as many, I guess, configurations of the symptoms as there are people. I mean, that it's very personal. But did you know so much about the illness before you started, or did you learn this in the process of working on the book?
Well, I'd say I learned a lot working on the book. I mean, I knew of my symptoms. I knew of some of the symptoms of other people I'd spoken with. But I didn't have a clear idea of, like, the distinction between positive and negative symptoms. I knew that the illness manifests differently in different people, because, you know, we're all different, and also our chemical systems are different too, and that affects, like, the medication. Medication is a big issue. The medicines can work for you, and they can also work against you sometimes. The side effects can be very severe. And often, with most people, it's a real trial and error before you find the medicine that works best for you.
And in this book, you talk about meds, and you talk also about the medical profession and what's helpful and what's not, your experiences of it. How tell a little bit about that. I mean, talk a little bit more about, you know, the differences in medication. And I don't mean the chemical differences in medication so much as, like you were saying, the sometimes the side effects can be.
I mean, when I first became ill, which was back in 89, the first med they put me on was just horrendous. It was Haldol, and it caused what I didn't know was then, and I know now, is known as akathisia. And akathisia is can be a very severe side effect where
what
you feel
that?
Like you're crawling out of your skin. You know, you've heard of restless leg syndrome. It's like restless leg syndrome throughout your entire body. And, you know, of course, I was newly ill, and I thought it was just part of my illness, and I didn't know. So I suffered under this med for months and months before I finally, you know, found something else.
How did you find something else?
Well, I basically told my doctor, you know, I was just tearing my hair out. I was just so uneasy. And so he tried me on something else, which worked for a while. But I probably have been on maybe 8 or 10 different types of antipsychotics. And the one that I'm on now has worked well for me. It's called Zyprexa. I've had it since 98. And I have been free of mostly free of symptoms, not completely, since then. I haven't been hospitalized since then. And so that's done a lot. And I think also what's helped me is been meditation and prayer.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot in this book, we also wrote essays at the back of the book, and I talked about how the illness affects you on four levels, physically, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually. And I said the last one is usually ignored because it's either feared or misunderstood. And you know, your therapist or your doctor may not share the same faith as you, or may not have faith at all. So it can be tricky. But I do believe that, you know, it's a mind and brain illness, and the chemical part needs to be treated with medication. Emotion. We all have emotional scars, and we have to work through those in this life. And also, the illness itself can bring emotional problems as well. I mean, it's just devastating. When it hits you, you know, you lose everything. You lose your job, you lose your, you know, sometimes your family and your friends. You know, you just ostracized for a while, at least until they come to know that you're, you know, a person. You know, just a real person with an illness. And then, you know, there's the psychological part, and all these overlap. And the psychological, I think in order to really progress in healing in the illness, you need to learn to think differently. And I think the meditation helps with that.
It's very interesting that you bring that up. I've heard that quite a few places recently, and I know I've read quite a bit by Thomas More, who was a former priest who became a therapist, and he talks about the importance of the soul and understanding, you know, the value of the spiritual and soulful connections when you're trying to deal with illnesses like this. And so I believe it's really true that, I mean, the issue of the spiritual, but you don't find that written about or spoken about. There's an awful lot of research done, you know, into the medicines and, you know, the chemical, physiological, biological,
and psychological,
but not the spiritual.
No, and I'm in process of working on a spiritual memoir, which will go into some detail of some of the experiences that I've had while being psychotic, and how it relates on a spiritual level as well. And I think everybody's got to find their faith, but whatever your faith is, I think if you have this illness, I would recommend, you know, trying to either, if you meditate or pray, and include it in part of your therapy, because you know, it affects the way you think and the way you are in your inner being, and it radiates to your outer being as well.
Absolutely. And I think that's true of all human beings, that's very important, and if we neglect it, then we suffer, you know. Mm-hmm. But for this, tell us more about what you're working on. And you've been a student. You have degrees from UNC, and you are a poet, and you're working on a novel. Is it okay for me to say?
Sure, okay. Sure, yeah. I'd headed back to school recently, and just decided that it was kind of felt like a square peg going in a round hole. It wasn't a good choice for occupation for myself. I think the field itself has changed a great deal in the last 15 years, even the last 5 to 10 years, and I don't feel my strengths match it well. So I've pulled out of school, and the thing was is that, you know, while I was in school, I didn't write one word for 2 years, and so I'm just getting back now to writing. I feel like I'm sort of incubating. I often feel like I need to learn something sometimes before I can go back to the writing. But I started a Christian fantasy novel before I started school, and it deals with the tougher questions of Christianity and proposes some possible answers for some of the things that are usually overlooked or just brushed under the carpet because they cause philosophical difficulties, you know, for people.
Can you give us an example of one of the questions?
It proposes to give an answer to that age-old question, why bad things happen to good people. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's based on scripture and also on a vision I had. And this is what's so tough sometimes, because I've had visions when I've not been psychotic, and I've had visions when I was psychotic, and so I always worry about my credibility to the public because of my illness. But I think that if I can back it up with some real hard scripture, it might stand the weight of criticism. So
I think one of the quotations in here, and one that I have loved for a very long time, is from Albert Einstein, who says that imagination is more important than knowledge. Visions are common to artists everywhere, whether or not they suffer from, you know, a mental illness. And we do seem to live in a society that seems to react as if having a vision somehow means you're
loco.
Crazy. Okay, crazy. Yeah. Let's call it what it is.
Yeah,
right?
We actually,
but it's not.
In the book, getting back to the book a little bit, we one of the questions we asked of people with the illness was If they had any favorite euphemisms or sayings that describe, because for crazy there are a lot of them, and you know, it's actually, there's a lot of humor in the book as well.
Yes, and there is.
One of my favorite was "Off Your Rocker," kind of like that. Yeah. You're off your rocker. So, but that's sort of an aside. But
no, but it's good. There are, the book is salted and peppered with some wonderful quotations and some wonderful poems that were written by or is every one of the poems, were they written by someone who is featured? I mean, one of the people who responded
no,
to the book?
No, we actually, we opened up the poetry to people who had any kind of mental illness. And we didn't just choose the people that did the interviews or the author editors ourselves. You know, we opened it up and we discussed as a group which ones, you know, we thought would be most appropriate for whichever chapter we were featuring. Because the book is split up into several chapters, and then each chapter begins with a poem, and a quote.
Yes, I'm going to read here just from the table of contents. It starts with, and also I'll give you, tell you where you can learn more and get a copy of the book. But the table of contents, it starts with symptoms of schizophrenia, and then how we wrote the book, and then the chapters are illness and recovery, medication, hospitals, therapies, and clubhouses, mental health professionals, support systems, relationships and spirituality, community living, education and employment, health and substance use and abuse, the media and interests, the system and financial concerns, and chapter 11, the last, is stigma. Now, all right.
That's hard to do in a short book.
Yes. Yeah, but y'all did, you did a remarkable job. It's really a wonderful, everyone I know, including myself and my son who has read this book, has said it was gripping. They couldn't put it down. They just started and kept reading.
Yeah, maybe I'll give an example of some of the answers in the book. Here's one that I think is pretty poignant. Given by the fake name of Barnaby, and he was 23 years old. We also had ages we put in here. And he says, it's about suicide. He says, "I've been suicidal, and I can tell you that when you are in that mindset, thinking about ending your life is kind of a release. That's why I kept thinking about it, but putting it off. Thinking that you only have a few days that left makes those days stress-free and almost fun because nothing matters. And you don't feel pressed to actually do it. What got me through? Now that I believe in God, I would never attempt it again. But at the time, I couldn't fully pull myself away from people. I couldn't stand the idea of never seeing them again." So.
Wow.
I thought that was well done. And on a very serious and difficult subject.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example of something from one of the essays in the back from my good friend Pickens Miller, who unfortunately passed away within the last couple of months. But he wrote a very poignant essay in the back of the book. And he writes, "People frequently use our diagnosis both to delegitimize our own perspective on events and also to justify their violence against us. Because they feel they can abuse us with no fear of consequence, and often with complete impunity, they believe that by undercutting our credibility in the case of a perceived threat, that they can get away with all violence towards us, including murder. Their mantra is always that, quote, they are worried about us, and then proceed to attack us, or in a punitive fit, with no reasonable alibi, place us in a hospital to hide their own culpability."
Wow.
Now, I know there's some pain there, but there's also some truth there.
There's
well.
A lot of truth there, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So. And then on a lighter note, unless you wanted to ask me a question, I'll...
No, go ahead.
Let's see. I'm trying to find...
Well, while you're finding that, I'm just going to tell folks this. Is this, do you know, is iUniverse still the place to go to get copies of the books?
You can get copies from My Universe, who is our printer.
Okay.
Print on demand. And then you can also get it through Amazon.com.
Good.
Okay. Or I guess that's the primarily those two. I know that you have to type in the either one of the author's names or the complete title, not just Our Voices, but Our Voices, colon, First Person Accounts of Schizophrenia.
Okay, Our Voices, colon, First Person Accounts of Schizophrenia. And you can find that at www.iuniverse.com. And that's the letter I, universe.com. Or and Amazon, everybody knows. So, did you found it?
Yeah, I found what I was looking for. This is by Jade, 43 at the time. It's what we called an elaboration. At the back of each chapter, we allowed people to tell maybe a little vignette, a little story. So she says, I went to buy this antique mirror in Alamance County, and a woman asked me what I did for a living. I stumbled a little bit and then said, I work at Club Nova Thrift Shop. She said, oh, that's wonderful. I like to shop there. They give the money to take care of the mentals. I almost broke up laughing, but I contained myself until I was out of the store and could share the story with my dad. You know, we can laugh at our illness,
yes.
You know, and but, you know, the stigma thing is huge, and I guess that's why I'm sort of coming out and speaking today to try to show people that, you know, there's... You know, we're people, and we, you know, we vary from individual to individual. We have relationships, we have beliefs and ideas, and we some of us are very creative and
very,
you know, so we're just people, you know. And I think, you know, it's hard. Like Pickens, my friend that died, he used to say, you know, if you have something wrong with your kidney, you know, people don't start to question your credibility. But, you know, if you have something wrong with your mind, they do. And I see the validity of that to some extent. But once you know, you've stabilized, you know, you're just a person.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. And I have been, in the interest of full disclosure, I have been working for... since 2000 in the Department of Psychiatry, and I worked with the Brushes with Life Gallery, which is where I met you and your wife Claudia and Colette and Manisha and Bibi and Jenny. And what I found was a wealth of people who are wonderful and warm and talented and really incredibly full of life, instead of so many just sometimes without the kinds of filters that society imposes on us. It puts between us and each other so that we can't connect. And I have found just it's been remarkable and very, very rewarding to get to know everybody and see the talent and the warmth and wonder.
If I could put in a little plug for Brushes with Life, on the third floor of the Neuroscience Hospital is where they
yes.
have the exhibits, and they have showings every so often. They'll have a showing, and one time I shared this poem, and I don't know if we have time for it.
Oh yes, you have plenty of time.
All right.
Yes.
This is one poem that I wrote that I thought has a little bit of humor in it, and maybe a little bit of my take on the illness, but not completely. Called Jar of Clay. I am but a jar of clay, molded and scolded, prodded and trodden, broken beneath my maker's feet. Yet still the dross remains, and though it might cause pain, into the kiln I go again to face the fire that purges sin. Who says clay cannot thrice be baked? Surely, you say, the jar may break. Indeed, says the potter, that is my intent. For clay once baked cannot be bent, but must be broken, though the shard shall prick my scarred hands, and the mere sight of it will make me sick. Is there yet not another way than to destroy this precious little jar of clay? Asked my friend of the potter, as the oven got hotter and hotter. It is for that very reason I place it back in the fire, that it may be refined, not destroyed, My desire is to glue back the pieces once the dross is purged, for I am a healer and a painstaking surgeon. My scalpel is sharp, but my hand is true. I shall cut out the sin and apply the glue, for I do not wish to sever healthy tissue. So I take my time. Yes, patience is a virtue. And carefully then I suture the open wound, glue back the pieces and leave the room, and wait for yet another day when I will return and refine the clay. I see, said my friend. I was actually quite blind. Now that I see your aim, you are actually quite kind. Easy for you to say, I complained to my friend. Just wait for your turn to be purged of sin. O little clump of clay, my hands do not tire, said the potter to me. You're going back in the fire.
Now, you read that at the opening of one of the gallery openings. That's where I first heard it. It's changed some since then.
Yeah.
So you went back and worked on it?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Little bit.
Wonderful. I like the way you've extended it, too. So you are writing again.
Yes.
Can you talk some about your writing? Or are you?
Well, as I said, I'm mostly incubating right now. It had been a couple of years since I'd written anything, so I had to go back and sort of read through and kind of get it back into me again before I can actually start producing,
yes.
Especially for the novel.
Right.
Like I said, the novel addresses the difficult questions of Christianity, It involves a parallel universe. It's got some physics in it. One of my hobbies is
oh wow,
cosmology and quantum physics. I enjoy so it's got a parallel universe with a whole nother race that are actually an angelic race, and you might think of it on another dimension, basically. Things start to happen in that dimension as a result of actions in this world, and. So the angelic race, which I don't know, I was going to call them just elves, but I may create a new word for them, I think, because they're really not just elves. They're actually a higher plane of creatures, beings. And what happens is the book actually begins in the Garden of Eden, and. Rather than a tree of the knowledge of good and evil, there's a portal. It's a pillar of flame that goes down as far down as you can see. It goes down into the ground, and it goes up into the sky. And basically, it's a portal that through which the unseen world, the spiritual dimension, can be bridged. And the twist on the book is that Adam and Eve have a brother and a sister. And the brother is the villain, and he listens to the serpent and learns how to open this dimension. And so rather than eating of a tree, which, you know, I feel is a metaphor in for coming to the knowledge of good and evil, so in the Bible. He opens up this, and this pillar of flame just disintegrates, and evil starts spreading over creation. And what happens is a black hole is created in the galaxy that the Earth is in, and it starts sucking energy down into it, as a black hole does, and spouting it into a parallel universe where the other beings are. And all of a sudden, they're starting to have matter in their universe, and they don't like it. So the king of those angelic beings sends his high priest over. And then there involves a time travel element to it. But in the meantime, you know, the characters, Adam and Eve, are trying to figure out where did this evil come from, and why is it here, and why does it exist?
Wow,
and I
didn't
give some
mean
possible
to
answers.
Tempt you into giving
away
the story,
a lot.
Well, that's okay. It is copyrighted here.
Okay.
This is Michael Dunn's idea, and no one else's.
Yeah,
okay?
So.
I look forward to it. Wow, it's very complex.
I've written a fantasy novel, and I decided not to publish it, because after going to a couple of writers' conferences, I realized I'd done a lot of things wrong. And what I did was...
We'll go ahead and finish this, and then we've got to take a station break.
But. Okay. Well, I went to a couple of writers' conferences and got some good advice, and then I just thought for like 2 months about what I was trying to say. Uh-huh. And then what came to me was a series, a trilogy, and to start out in the Garden of Eden rather than just create a whole new world and you know, address the issues right where they are. So.
I love it. I love it. We'll be back with Michael Dunn in just a minute. We have to stop and tell you about our underwriter. Dick, you want it? Oh, you don't have a mic. Do you want it?
Yeah, I'll give it a little talk here. We are brought to you by Internationalist Bookstore, 405 West Franklin Street. The little bookstore that has the stuff that you won't find anywhere else because it's definitely different. And it's also a community resource where things happen, where people share information about things happening in other places. And it's a wonderful community resource. You can find it, as I said, at 405 West Franklin Street, or you can go on the web at internationalistbooks.org.
Thank you. And now we're going to tell you also to go check out our website, Triangle Wilf, that is WILPF, for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, trianglewilf.org. You can also check out our other radio programs by going to WCOMFM.org. That's the website for this radio station, and there you can look it through our archives and listen to past radio programs. You can also stream it live while we're on air.
And you can also find the archives on the WILF website.
Oh, the archives are also, that's right, I forgot about that. The archives are also on the TriangleWILF.org website. We are back again with Michael Dunn, an extremely creative, talented, bright, and vibrant young man that I met when I was working with the Brushes with Life Gallery. And Michael is one of the author editors of Our Voices, First-Person Accounts of Schizophrenia. Michael, your wife Claudia Moon is also a very talented artist. I own a painting done by you and one done by Claudia too. I have them in my living room.
I jest. I'm the painter of one painting. That was the first painting I had done since I was in middle school. And I tried to copy, with a little ad lib, Monet.
And that's the title of it, ad lib.
Yeah,
Monet.
And then somebody else wanted it. I guess you bought it, and then somebody else wanted one, so I painted it again. And I that's my jest, is I can only paint one painting.
Anyway, I love it. I bought it as a gift for my significant other, and he loves it. So,
thank you.
And Claudia, has done some remarkable work. There's a poem here, Poem for Progress, in here. Would you you think she'd mind if we read it?
No, why don't you do so?
Okay. Let me put my glasses back on. Okay. Poem for Progress by Claudia Moon. Imagine robots on skateboards, bumping into each other's shadows. It's we I speak of, on our appointed hallway for at least 72 hours. Bumping into each other, bumping into each other's shadows. Different diagnoses, the same pathos, a loss of self, the blending of boundaries, lips chalky with medication, arms stiff from side effects. There's no value in saying, excuse me. We know there is no purpose in any collision. Bones and bodies carry the exhaustion of horrifying images, the constant strain of words attacking, the floors shifting below with no pattern. Our knocking bones recognize these traits within one another, familiar like blood cousins, going in no real direction. We push past each other, heading for the same place.
She's very talented.
She really is, yes.
She, you know, I have a hard time getting her just to share some of her poetry with me.
Oh, yeah?
And But she's very talented.
Yes.
We write very different types of poems. But I like hers, she likes mine, so I guess that works.
It works out well. Yes. Yes, it's good.
That poem is very real, as far as it's something I think most of us who have been in hospitals can relate to. I mean, when I've been hospitalized years ago, I'm almost like a trapped animal. And you've seen, you know, like a leopard in captivity pacing.
Yes.
And then that's what I do when I've been in the hospital. It's been a long time, but that's what I've always done when I was hospitalized, was pace. And that's a poem that's largely about pacing.
Yes, it precedes the section on hospitalization in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. But does Claudia react the same way? Is this the...
Not to the extent, I think, that I do. Obviously, she's probably done it.
Observed it, yes.
Yeah, so...
But, yeah, I can understand that. But... is there anything else that you would like us to talk about before?
Well, I know I started out by talking about how the illness affects us on every level.
Yes.
And I thought maybe I could read my last paragraph in my essay.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
All right. We have no rush, by the way. We have plenty of time. So,
okay.
But if read anything that you would like. I'd read the whole book out loud if I could.
Well, maybe I'll save it then for when we finish up, and I'll read a little bit more from the book.
Yes.
There's an interesting page to give an idea of like a whole page. And it's on stigma, and we spoke of stigma.
Yes.
And the question is, what misconceptions do you think that people have about mental illness? Do people treat you differently when they learn about your illness? And the first one is Jade. She says, I think people think I'm a little strange, but I don't usually tell them I'm schizo. I just don't worry about it. They might have the same problem themselves. Next one, Socrates. I once told a woman in a bar that I suffer from schizoaffective disorder, and she asked me if I had multiple personalities. Up until I told her about my illness, she seemed very interested in me. After I told her about my illness, she quickly left the bar. Here's another one from Jane. I think that people are often afraid of insanity in another person. I don't know if people treat me differently when they know about my mental illness. I've often had difficulty making friends anyway. And then Barnaby, I've been written off before as crazy. Some people seem to think that if you have a mental illness, you are not worthwhile or not as much of a person as people without an illness. They dehumanize you with your diagnosis. As far as people learning about my illness, the people who care are kind even if they don't understand. I had one friend who is scared of me now. I think that people with mental illness need to stay social and with people they can trust. I lost a lot of social skills when I got sick, and the only way to get them back is to be with people. So it gives you an idea of varying responses.
Do you think that the response, the misconceptions, have changed any sort of over, you know, in the last 10 years?
I would like to think so, yeah. I think one of the things, it's sad to say it, but more and more people are being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So I think more people are aware of that particular illness as a mental illness. And it might, you know, hit the person next door for all you know. It's interesting. Often, like I was first diagnosed as bipolar when I became ill. And it's often hard to distinguish between bipolar disorder sometimes and schizoaffective. They can be similar. A person with bipolar can actually have some psychosis at times.
Okay.
And I guess the distinction is if your schizophrenic symptoms, your positive symptoms, say hallucinations, audio or visual, or persist, If those symptoms persist, even outside of a psychotic episode, which is usually a brief period, you know, usually you might be diagnosed that therefore as schizoaffective rather than bipolar. I don't know that for sure, but that's what I think is the distinction. But I think it's difficult even for the professionals sometimes to know at first whether you're bipolar or you're schizoaffective.
Yes, I'm sure it is. You know, it's funny you said that, you know, more people are being diagnosed with bipolar. And as my father was diagnosed late in life with bipolar, and it, on the one hand, it helped us all come to terms with some of his behaviors over the years that we had not understood. But it was quite rare at the time. And we're talking back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly rare. And it, you know, the family was really not sure what to do, how to deal with it, what kind of, for a while he was on some heavy medication, lithium at one time. I mean, and he ultimately decided to stop his medication because he said it was either live on this roller coaster or be a zombie. You know,
right.
He said there seemed to be no in between for him, and he'd rather ride the roller coaster.
Yeah, that can be, you know, it's hard sometimes for people because of the side effects of the medications, and especially, 30, 40 years ago, they had the first generation antipsychotics and like Haldol and Thorazine and stuff that really makes you a zombie. And it's very hard to take a medicine like that when you're trying to live your life. But now with the newer antipsychotics, the second generation, which have been out, I guess, at least for 20 to 30 years now.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of them. Most people are on the second generation. There will be some side effects, but they're not as intolerable as some of the others were. And I really believe that you know, the first step to recovery is learning that you have to take medicine for the rest of your life. And, you know, as I say in my essay, you know, lots of people have to take medicine for the rest of their lives for various ailments.
Yes.
And so it's no shameful thing to have to do. Well, you know, part of the illness is they're finding strong genetic indicators that if you have certain genes, you are vulnerable to perhaps trigger this illness. Schizophrenia, and the environment can play a role in triggering it, so that it's a genetic biochemical deficiency. You may have too much serotonin going across your synapses in your brain, and you need something to bind to those receptors. They believe they're not really sure how some of these work. It's a lot of trial and error, but you know, once you can get the chemistry a little bit under control, then you know it's more tolerable, and you can actually go on and do some good things in your life.
Yes, I know that the medications can do can do great things, can work wonders and help people. But on the other hand, I mean, with the increased numbers of diagnoses, you have to wonder, what else might be going on in our society? I mean, there are two quotes in your book that make me think that this reminded me of. One of them is from Artie Lang, who said, "Insanity, a perfectly rational adjustment to an insane world." And the other is Krishnamurti, "It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society." And how often I find myself wondering when I read about record numbers of diagnoses, particularly of children, you know, with some sort of mental disorder, you know, whether our society isn't out of whack and we're medicating, you know, to help our children adjust to what is, and in some ways, a sick society, you know.
Yeah, I know that society definitely has its ailments, but I think that's why I'm a big proponent of meditation, because you know, I've had friends laugh at me when I say this. Sometimes I restrict how much stuff I put into my head from the outside. You know, I may decide not to watch the news tonight, you know, or whatever, because I just don't want to. I don't have my filters. You know, that stuff's just gonna hit me so deeply, yes, it's going to cause me more trouble. But you can't live in a fantasy world too, so you've got to.
Right.
But I think it's important to, you know, with our society, you know, with so much competition in our society and things speeding up, and you, now you've got, you know, the technology, it's just, you know, you hear these horrible things about, you know, these young people committing suicide because of bullying, internet bullying, mm-hmm, and you know, before they've even had a chance to figure out who they are, you know?
Yes.
And so, you know, every technology, I always feel like it's got its pluses and its minuses. And truly, to be honest with you, I limit how much technology I take in.
Yes.
And I have to balance it with doses of isolation and meditation. It's the only way I can stay functional.
Yes.
You know, and not just get overwhelmed.
I can really understand that. I'm one of those people too who, I guess I'm what Carl Jung called an introvert, a true introvert, because for me, being around people for long periods of time can be draining, and I need to be alone in order to get re-energized. And the quiet time and turn everything off. There are times when I'll go around and turn everything off. I mean, including the refrigerator. It's just, I feel like I can feel the electricity just surging. And so I just need quiet. And then I have to take myself away.
Sure.
So I really understand, and I value meditation. I can't say I'm very good at it. My mind is always busy, and it's hard to turn it off. But that is the challenge, and that is the point of meditation, is to keep trying. It's,
yeah,
like bringing, you know, a child back and just focus again and try again.
Yeah, yeah, usually when I actually do my meditation, not sitting like in a yoga position, I lie down, because I find that there's, when I'm lying on the floor, there's nothing that's strained in my body. I'm totally, it's easier for me to be totally at ease in my body. And then I often usually begin by allowing just whatever is flowing through my mind just to kind of float around. And there may be a number of thoughts, and then I'll just, you know, if something causes some sort of like thorn in my side,
yeah,
I'll try to process whatever that is and release it. And then I start to focus. Then I'll focus on, for me, is God, and that's, you know, that's something I guess different people have to come to their own awareness of, you know, it's from years and years of prayer and interaction. I know I could tell you stories about answered prayers that are just like amazing sometimes, but you know, I have a place where, you know, I can, for me, it's the Holy Spirit. You know, for a Hindu, it might be the Atman or Brahma or Krishna. You know, I don't know. But for me, you know, it's the Holy Spirit, and that's God within. And then I just focus on him and or her, him, it. I always feel like God is, it's got all the masculine and feminine together.
Yes.
And in fact, for me, the Holy Spirit has characterized as the comforter, and so more for me the feminine energy, but then my mind may be directed towards the masculine energy, towards God the Father or towards Jesus, you know, and I will just focus, and sometimes, you know, I engage in a conversation. I know that sounds crazy, but
no,
I do.
it doesn't at all.
Yeah. And you know, and for me, it's a way for me to center and,
uh-huh,
and process. Because, you know, with this illness, you know, at different times, my filter, what we call filters, which is basically, I always say that the window between the spiritual realm and the physical realm is thinner for people with mental illness. And so, like, you know, like in my essay, I talk about how, like, you know, sometimes we can feel people,
yes,
looking at us. There's something that's invisible that passes. I call that spirit. And, you know, I think sometimes my filters are stronger than others. I don't know why. But sometimes, like, I don't just see people, I feel them. And if there's a darkness in there, I feel that darkness as if it were in myself. So I have to process that. And I've learned to actually almost put up a wall while it's coming at me, and it lessens the impact. But, you know, that's just, I think different people have that, whether they have mental illness or not. to varying degrees. It's a sliding scale, and I think mental health is a sliding scale as
well. Absolutely. A whole spectrum. I mean, it's just, yeah, there's a continuum, I guess, would be the word. I think you're absolutely right, you know. How are we doing, Dick? We've got
9 minutes.
Okay.
9 minutes. Good. I didn't think I could talk for a whole hour, but I guess other people, if you ask them, would say, yes, he can.
Well, yes, that day I ran into you at Weaver Street, we talked for quite a while.
Yes.
And I hope you weren't too late picking up your wife.
No.
That's good. But, yes, actually, I think you're right. There is this continuum, and there's no sort of fixed place where you go from being, you know, sane to insane. That something happens, and it has to do with a whole configuration of events and circumstances and chemicals and
And I would say, this is just a personal belief. I don't think we ever arrive on this in this dimension, this physical dimension.
What do you mean?
We can never say that we are totally, you know, got all our problems worked out, and we're just, you know, on a higher plane than the rest of the world. You know, it's just, I don't think that happens. I mean, that goes against some other people's beliefs, but I know that I will never be completely worked out in this world. But it doesn't keep me from trying to, you know, become more aware of who I am and where I came from and where I'm going. And
I've never met anyone, I think, that was without, you know, their own. My ex-husband used to say, if you don't think somebody's weird, it's probably because you don't know them. And, you know, all of us have our own little quirks and quibbles and quiddities, and, you know,
But that's also what makes us lovable, too.
You're right. It's what makes us interesting, certainly, in this world. But some of the most supposedly together people I've ever met have something that's not quite right when you actually get to know them.
It's that paradox. It's the paradox that if you think you've arrived, then you haven't. So you never do.
Right.
You know. But, you know, that's all right. I think we can find a degree of fulfillment even in this imperfect world, in this imperfect dimension.
When
you have this illness, it causes you to have to look in. You got to look inside. You know, if you want to heal, you've got to look inside. And you don't always like what you see. But if you keep looking, you know, you can keep processing and keep growing. And I think that's what it's all about here in this world is just growing. And we're fortunate in this country, you know, to be able to some degree to have the time to not be always just scurrying around to meet our physical needs. Now, we do have to do that to some extent. Most of us work 9 to 5, 5 days a week or more. But, you know, in a lot of countries, you know, we all know this, you know, they don't have the luxury of maybe, or maybe not having to scurry around to get all their physical needs gives them time for meditation. I don't know. But I think that, I think on the whole, we in this country are very blessed and we should remember that.
Yes.
But not get caught up in just the physical. Because we're a lot more than that.
Yes.
And we, you know, as I say, we don't take the things with us. We take ourselves with us when we go. So we can't deny ourselves.
No,
it's the time for ourselves, and that's what's going to carry on if you believe in going, you know, in life after this.
Yes. So. Yes. I think that's very true. I think that's some profound thoughts.
This is dangerous to put me on a radio show. I get on my soapbox here.
I think it's wonderful. I think you're remarkable. I love it. Tremendous insights. We are going to have to wrap up. You had a paragraph you wanted to read.
Yeah, I was hoping to read this last paragraph in my essay. So Here it goes. So, I would encourage all those with mental illness and those close to them to have hope. When things are bad and you're in a dark tunnel, it is hard to have hope, but that is the essence of faith. Strides are being made in understanding and responding to this devastating illness, and though you may never return to how you were before your illness, the process of looking within can yield growth. You may have to come to know yourself in a new way, but it is possible, though not easy, to emerge from the darkness a changed person, one that understands his or her shortcomings and strengths and accepts himself or herself and those around them with more kindness and humility.
And that's what it's all about for all of us.
You know, yeah.
Those aren't just words for those who struggle with this illness, but for all of us, I think. Very true. Michael, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate your having come today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I want to say again that you can find this incredible book, Our Voices, First Person Accounts of Schizophrenia, edited by Colette Corr, Colettecorr, by Michael Dunn, that's Dunne, by Manisha Kapil, Manisha Kapil, by the late Pickens Miller, and by Claudia Moon, Moon. And they are, it's really worth reading. You won't regret it, not for a second. And you can find it through www.iuniverse.com. Or through Amazon.com. And I want to, once again, we want to give you the Brushes with Life is the gallery on the third floor at UNC Hospitals in the Neurosciences Hospital. You can find that website. I think it's still functional. Brushes with Life, just Google Brushes with Life, and you should find a website. I know they're working on a new one, and I don't know if the other one's down yet, but in any case, Brushes with Life Gallery. It's part of the Step Art Gallery at UNC. And one other resource I'd like to tell you about, if you are interested or you have a family member who is struggling with mental illness, there is a wonderful organization. It is the National Association for Mental Illness, NAMI, NAMI.org. And you can go to their website and find a lot of resources. And I think that this book was also going to be available. I know we told them about it, and so I'll check with that. But
okay, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. This has been the Peace and Justice Hour from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. You can go to our website, trianglewilf.org. And we have been brought to you by Internationalist Books at internationalistbooks.org. I know you're getting tired of hearing websites today. Okay. But thank you, and join us again next week. And tune in.
I wanted to remind everybody to save the date, December 5th, which is a Sunday. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Triangle Branch, will be having its 75th anniversary celebration. We've been here since 1935, and we're happy to keep it on going.
That's just in Chapel Hill.
That's in Chapel Hill. The International was founded in 1915, so we're not too far behind in getting started here. Only 20 years later. And we definitely want you to come and celebrate with us. Keep the date, December 5th, and we'll let you know more details as they become available.
Oh, thanks for that, Dick. I had completely forgotten about our 75th. Thanks again. Join us again next week.